Good afternoon. I guess we're ready to resume our study of the book of Daniel. We've got lots of material to cover today. My design and desire is to finish the third and fourth chapters today. Let's quickly finish up the second chapter. Before I do that, though, I do want to quickly make a correction concerning something I said Monday, which Evan Wright was in a very nice way informed me I was incorrect about. In trying to establish the It's a true concept, but I established it with a bogus example. I was trying to point out how that some languages make sounds that other languages don't. And you may recall I said the Chinese did not have the L sound in it. I either got that from a bogus source or misunderstood the source or assumed something wrong, but Evan, who knows some Chinese, told me that's not correct. He did inform me that Vietnamese and Japanese, which are related, they have an L sound as well, I believe, but sometimes they will make it at the incorrect time. Is that correct, Evan? When they're pronouncing an English word? Okay, all right. Which causes them to mistakenly pronounce things at times. Okay. Maybe a different example. When I was in high school, I know about as much about Hebrew as I do Chinese, maybe just a smidgen more, but we sang a Hebrew song, and I'm sure we probably butchered the pronunciation, but it went something like this. Erev shev shoshanim netse nachabustan. That sound that I tried to make that failed in making probably. You know, there's a sound that the Hebrew speaker makes that we don't make. We talk about Loch Ness. The folks across the pond, some of them may pronounce it Loch Ness. Now, if I say it, I'm not going to go around saying Loch Ness because that's not natural to me. I change it. And over time, so you get one word that comes into multiple languages and it can come out different ways even though it's the same word. But we're past that, but wanted to make that correction. We read verses 44 and 45 yesterday. Let's pick up in 46 now. We didn't get to see Nebuchadnezzar's response to being told what the dream was. But we do get to see his response to having heard the dream and the interpretation, and it's a striking response. Daniel chapter 2, verse 46, King Nebuchadnezzar fell on his face, prostrate before Daniel, and commanded that they should present an offering and incense to him. Now New King James did say fall prostrate. The NIV says something similar. KJV, worship. ASV says the same thing. The NAS, ESV say did or paid homage. This word can refer to worship. Doesn't necessarily have to refer to worship. But it does have to do with the idea for sure of paying some kind of obeisance or homage, making it clear to another that you see their superiority. It may be, though, that Nebuchadnezzar is, in fact, worshiping Daniel in some respect here because we see the rest of the verse. He commanded that they should present an offering and incense to him. Now, this is the sort of thing you do when you're worshiping something you regard as divine. We know what God's servants elsewhere in Scripture have done when someone bowed down to them. When Cornelius bowed down to Peter, what did Peter say? Get up. I myself am also a man. When John fell down before those two heavenly beings in Revelation, what did they say? No. Don't do that. Get up. We don't get Daniel's response here. And, you know, there's a part of you that might think it would be nice to know what Daniel did here. Knowing the kind of man Daniel was, I think it's certainly plausible and reasonable to suggest he rejected this, begged Nebuchadnezzar not to do it. Please, this is not appropriate. This is not for me. But I don't have a biblical description of what he did. So I don't have anything to go on there except what I know of his character. Notice verse 48, verse 47. The king answered Daniel and said, "Truly your God is the God of gods and the Lord of kings." The King of Kings says your God is the Lord of kings and a revealer of secrets since you could reveal this secret. Then the king promoted Daniel and gave him many great gifts and he made him ruler over the whole province of Babylon and chief administrator over all the wise men of Babylon. Notice verse 47, by the way, this statement about God. This is the first of what I'm just going to call evangelistic declarations in the book of Daniel. Maybe strictly speaking, it's not evangelistic, but it is a pagan king in a Gentile language now proclaiming that this Hebrew God is someone to take note of. He's not yet saying he's the only God, but he's calling attention to this God, and he's on his way in the right direction. At the end of verse 48, notice Daniel was made chief administrator over all the wise men. Just file that in the back of your mind for something we're going to encounter a little bit later. Verse 49, also Daniel petitioned the king. And he set Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego over the affairs of the province of Babylon. But Daniel sat in the gate of the king. So he gets his break, right? His big break. He's ascended to a position of high authority. But he doesn't forget his friends. He calls upon the king, please, if you will, bring them along to some extent. And the king does so. And Daniel gets this position, which is described as sitting in the gate of the king. This was a post of chief honor and dignity as a counselor of a king. The gate of the city in the east is the place where courts are held. It's the place where public business was usually transacted. Daniel may be receiving a position, something like a prime minister here. And he may not even be 20. Pretty remarkable thing. Are there any closing comments about chapter 2? We want to get to chapter 3 quickly here. Yes, Steve.
Regarding this offering being made.
Yes.
I don't know.
It may have been an affront to the king. I can't help but wonder if it would have been an affront to God, though. But I don't know. So, yes, Mike.
I think we can pretty well tell from what happened later that Nebuchadnezzar kind of fully really bought into the idea that God is the ultimate God.
Absolutely not. Absolutely
but
not.
He is clearly saying that this God is superior, at least in this matter, compared to what all the other gods are able to do.
Yes, yes. It's a step in the right direction for him. And that's one of the neat things of Daniel. These chapters are stair steps. Chapter 2, he takes one step in the right direction. Chapter 3, he's going to go again. And by chapter 4, he makes it. And maybe just with a year left of his life, perhaps, he makes it. Seems to have an understanding of who God really is. And let's just get into chapter 3. Someone once said, and I thought it was quotable, "It's true when you've done something wrong, you may have severe problems. But it's also true that when you've done what is right, you may go through the worst trials of your life." 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 19, Peter says, "For this is commendable, if because of conscience toward God, one endures grief, suffering wrongfully." Later in 1 Peter 2, "When you do good and suffer, if you take it patiently, this is commendable before God." We're about to read the work of Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, work that is commendable before God. Let's read about it. "Nebuchadnezzar the king made an image of gold, whose height was 60 cubits and its width six cubits. He set it up in the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon." Now, we don't know exactly when chapter 2 happens in relation to chapter 1. The Septuagint says it was in the 18th year of Nebuchadnezzar, which, if that's true, it's been 16 years since chapter 2. A big leap in time. None of the things that Daniel said would come true as a result of what that dream was predicting, none of them have come to pass. And it's possible, I suppose, you know, it's just been forgotten and not thought of too much by Nebuchadnezzar. But that's what the Septuagint says. This could be much closer to the events in chapter 2. And you do wonder, because Nebuchadnezzar has just seen a vision in which only the head was gold, and the message of that was, although your kingdom is great, it's limited, and it's going to end. And now suddenly, right after learning that, here at what's Nebuchadnezzar do but go make a whole image of gold, which he may be declaring what? Well, here's my vision for my empire. It's not going to end. I'm the one with the everlasting kingdom. I don't know that, but it's possible. He set this thing up being 60 cubits high and 6 cubits wide. There are different cubits, but if we take the 18-inch one, that of course is 90 feet by 9 feet, a 10-to-1 ratio. Now, these are not good human proportions. If this image did have the form of a human, we don't know exactly how it's measured. For example, if you measure a man from shoulder to shoulder, generally he's about 4.5 times high than he is wide. If you measure him at the waist, the width of the waist, he's at the most 6 times higher than he is wide. How you would get 1 to 10 is a little bit up in the air. Perhaps this image was sitting on a pedestal and that's being measured. Perhaps it had a hat. You know, we don't know for sure. But whatever the case, they're striking dimensions, and it's a whole lot of gold, even if it's not solid gold. It's set up in the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. We don't know exactly where that is. Lots of I don't knows. There is a river by this name, with Tulul Dura nearby. The river's Duru, but there's this place Dura nearby, so at least that name continued down through history for a time. Verse 2, King Nebuchadnezzar sent word to gather together the satraps, the administrators, the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the judges, the magistrates, and all the officials of the provinces. Seven offices mentioned there, maybe an eighth, depending upon how you choose to count officials, the last one mentioned, to come up to the dedication of the image which King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. This dedication is going to be mentioned again in the third verse. We're going to have a dedication ceremony. Let's get this thing rolling. This is a special occasion. We're going to have all the officials of the empire there. So, verse 3, the satraps, the administrators, the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the judges, the magistrates, and all the officials of the provinces gathered together for the dedication of the image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. And they stood before the image that Nebuchadnezzar had set up. So picture this in your mind. Here is, we are out on this plain. I don't know if we're totally exposed to the elements, just how this works, but here's this enormous image, and all these government officials, hundreds, and they are all assembled before this image, and they are standing, maybe under that harsh Babylonian sun. And then in verse 4, a herald cried aloud, "To you it is commanded, O peoples, nations, and languages, that at the time you hear the sound of the horn, flute, harp, lyre, and psaltery, and symphony with all kinds of music, you shall fall down and worship the gold image that Nebuchadnezzar has set up. And whoever does not fall down and worship shall be cast immediately into the midst of a burning fiery furnace." Let's talk a little bit about this furnace. I look up in Gesenius, I look up in Brown Driver Briggs, these Hebrew dictionaries, and they were helpful. They gave me the definition furnace. Unger helps a little bit, perhaps. He says that this is referring to a large crucible. Now, a crucible today is a container of graphite, porcelain, platinum, or some substance that resists great heat, and it's used for melting or fusing or calcining ores and metals and so forth. Sometimes this term crucible is used of the hollow at the bottom of an ore furnace where the molten metal collects. This is a place where metal, perhaps, is melted. Now, to do that requires some serious heat. It may have had an opening at the top, so says Unger, for a place for casting the material in, and a door at the bottom from which it could be the metal could be withdrawn. And we'll be referencing that door in just a little bit. But here the command is made. And of course you're to bow down when the music plays. I'm not going to go through all those instruments. That would have been a very different kind of music, I'm sure, than we're accustomed to hearing. It would have been nice to hear. I don't know if I would have liked it, but it would have been nice to hear. But when it comes, make sure you bow. Verse 7. So at that time, when all the people heard the sound of the horn, flute, harp, and lyre, and symphony with all kinds of music, all the people, nations, and languages fell down and worshipped the gold image which Nebuchadnezzar had set up. Everybody but three. Therefore, at that time, certain Chaldeans came forward and accused the Jews. Now, they're interested in doctrinal purity, right? They are interested in making sure that we're all on the same page in spiritual matters. You know, this is important. We all want to be beseeching this God, whoever this God is. We all want to be on the same page here. We want national unity. And these three guys are really standing in the way of some good things. I don't think that has anything to do with it. They spoke to the king and spoke and said to King Nebuchadnezzar, "O king, live forever. O king, you, O king, have made a decree that everyone who hears the sound of the horn, flute, harp, lyre, and psaltery, and symphony with all kinds of music, shall fall down and worship the gold image. And whoever does not fall down and worship shall be cast into the midst of a burning fiery furnace." There are certain, what? Jews. Those Jews. Those monotheistic Jews. Those exclusivist Jews who've got their own law, and all the rest of us get along, to go along, to get along. They're always making themselves different. And we think they've got positions they ought not have. Anti-Semitism's nothing new. There are certain Jews whom you have set over the affairs of the province of Babylon, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. These men, O king, have not paid due regard to you. Why would you word it that way? It's very slyly worded. Yeah. King, you're worthy of all this honor you're asking. We're on board with this. we believe that we ought to do this. These guys don't see it. They are insulting you by their refusal to pay allegiance to you in this matter. And that, by the way, is something that any one of us will encounter if we stand for the Lord. If we are allegiant to the Lord, we're going to have someone calling our allegiance to them into question. Verse 13. Nebuchadnezzar, in rage and fury, we've seen this from him before, gave the command to bring Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego to... So they brought these men before the king. Nebuchadnezzar spoke, saying to them, "Is it true, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that you do not serve my gods or worship the gold image which I have set up? Now, if you are ready, at the time you hear the sound of the horn, flute, harp, lyre, and psaltery, and symphony with all kinds of music, and you fall down and worship the image which I have made, good. But if you do not worship, you shall be cast immediately into the midst of a burning fiery furnace. And who is the God who will deliver you from my hands?" Shows his true colors, doesn't he? We smile about it, we laugh about it. It's so striking, but it's not really funny, is it? This is outrageous. And you know, it must be difficult, I would think, to have absolute power like an ancient monarch did and not get heady about it. I mean, here's a lifestyle like this man had. If you want the whole palace repainted just on a whim, it happens because you want it. If the supper is made for you and they slaved over it all day and you don't like it and you require something else and they have to stay up all night and kill a fatted calf and go to a whole bunch of extra effort to make it for you, you get it because you want it. His whole life is like that. Whatever he wants, he gets because he's king. And here are these three men from a subjugated race who he paid for to have them educated, and everything they have, as he sees it, they have because he has been gracious to give it to them, and they have the audacity not to bow down to his image. It's all self-centered, and it's all a failure to realize just how important worshiping the one true and living God really is. Verse 16, we get their response. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answered and said to the king, "O Nebuchadnezzar, we have no need to answer you in this matter." The NIV and NRSV render this, "We do not need to defend ourselves. We have no need to present a defense to you." Perhaps there's some of the idea in here that, "King, we don't owe you an explanation on this." Not said proudly, not said stridently, but said in conviction. "We don't owe you on this one. When it comes to our allegiance, there's one to whom we owe greater honor, and that's the decision we've made. We're not going to change our minds here. Our minds are made up just as yours is. Nothing you say or that we say is going to change our position, our resolution." That is not what Nebuchadnezzar wanted to hear, and it's not what he's used to hearing. He's a man that when he starts threatening, people respond. Here are hundreds, if not thousands, of people who've just bowed down because if they don't, he's going to do something to them. And here are these three men who won't do it. Verse 16. They said, "O Nebuchadnezzar, we have no need to answer you in this matter." Verse 17. "If that is the case, our God, whom we serve, is able to deliver us." Now, what did he just ask at the end of verse 15? "Now, who's the God that's going to be able to deliver you from my hands?" Well, they answer the question. "Our God will deliver us from your hands, from this burning fiery furnace, and He will deliver us from your hand, O King." It almost sounds like they possibly had some reason to expect that God would do this, but they're not certain, because in verse 18 they say, "If not," we don't know for sure what God will do, "if not, let it be known to you, O King, that we do not serve your gods, nor will we worship the gold image which you have set up." Service to God is not a ticket to an easy life. All things work together for good to those who love God, but not all things work to be easy. Romans 14:8 says, "If we live, we live to the Lord, and if we die, we die to the Lord. Therefore, whether we live or die, we are the Lord's." What did Job say? "Though he slay me, yet will I trust him." Revelation 12, verse 11, "Those who pleased God were those who did not love their lives to the death." Such men as this. Nebuchadnezzar now, verse 19, is full of fury. Verse 13 said he was in rage and fury. Now he's full of fury. And the expression on his face changed, it says, toward Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Now, I don't know for sure what we're seeing here. I mean, at this point, you know, up to this point, maybe it's been kind of an impatient endurance on his part. He's angry, and you can see it in his eyes and in his expression and in his visage. But now something happens. Something happens. And in light of what we know happens to this man in the next chapter, you do wonder if perhaps here are the early signs of the psychosis that's going to take him over. Here's a man teetering on the edge. Here's a man who gets really angry, insanely angry at these men. And he loses all restraint, all control, all the common sense things that would keep people from going over the edge in their declarations. Those all go by the wayside. And he calls out in verse 19, he spoke and commanded that they should heat the furnace 7 times more than it was usually heated. Now, could it really be done? Probably not. It's probably perhaps just an expression. Get it as hot as you can. It's a perfect number. Get it as hot as you can. And he commanded certain mighty men of valor who were in his army to bind Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego and cast them into the burning fiery furnace. Then these men were bound in their coats, their trousers, their turbans, and their other garments. Let me ask, why is that mentioned? Anyone have a thought? Verse 21, what's that? All right, they're all flammable. Any other thoughts? Okay. All right. All right. So perhaps we see the providence of God at work here, that these clothing will be on them so that you can see later that we didn't have any smell. But from the Babylonian standpoint, why do it this way? I mean, why not? We got some good clothes here, possibly. I mean, these may be government issue. Why don't we take these things off and make some use of them? Why not put some possible execution garment on them? What is the significance of this being done this way? That's it. I think that may be it. I want it done now. We're not going to go through any of the procedures that we might go through other times. These men have affronted me, and they're going to pay, and they're going to pay now. Get it in the fire. We heat it so hot, maybe hotter than it's ever been. We get some of the strongest men that we have, the kind of men you want to take care of. These are your good soldiers. You want to protect these guys. And what ends up happening to these men? They die. Notice, they're more afraid of Nebuchadnezzar than they are of the fire. We'll take our chances with the fire. But he loses some good men, as far as from a military standpoint, probably some of his strong men. He's in a hurry and he wants it done now. Therefore, verse 22, because the king's command was urgent and the fire exceedingly hot, the flame of the fire killed those men who took up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. No caution was exercised. All this was done in a hurry and a flurry. And when you do that, you make dumb decisions. And this is the result. Therefore, okay, verse 23. These three men, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, fell down bound into the midst of the burning fiery furnace. Then King Nebuchadnezzar was astonished, and he rose in haste and spoke, saying to his counselors. Now let's just stop right now. Verse 23, fell down bound. Perhaps here, if Unger's right, to get up here to the top of this thing, and this is big enough for three men, four men to be in. It's big enough for them to have room to walk around. This is a big crucible. Come up here to the top, wherever this hatch is or this opening. We cast them down. They're cast down bound. Now it's happened. Nebuchadnezzar is probably still seething, possibly. I don't know how much time transpires here, you know. I mean, it could be he just wrote this whole thing off. You know, oh, they got what they deserved. You know, it's 10, 15 minutes later. We don't know. But he's able to look in, perhaps through another opening. He's able to look in, and he is astonished, it says in verse 24. He rose in haste. So you see him. Here he is, maybe he just looks up. He gets up, you can just see it. And he rushes, he hurries, spoke to his counselors. Did we not cast three men bound into the midst of the fire? They answered instead of the king, true, O king. Look, he answered, I see four men loose, walking in the midst of the fire, and they are not hurt. And the form of the fourth is like the Son of God. The only thing that was burned in the fire is the thing which bound them, someone said. Now, sure, the binding, something else could have happened to it. God could have just made it evaporate away. But it may have been the fire consumed it, but nothing else. You know, maybe there's a sermon there for someone. Sometimes it takes a fire to loose us of the things that bind us. Sometimes it takes trial. Sometimes it takes difficulty to get us to throw off the shackles of a sin. These four men now are loose. They're not bound anymore. Walking in the midst of the fire. Notice that. I mean, you know, I have no idea what this would have been like. But we don't see them sitting there crouching. Can you believe this is happening? But there seems to be a level of comfort here, or a level of security, and they're roaming around, maybe taking it all in. You know, this is a once-in-a-lifetime experience. I mean, you're getting to look, you're walking on hot coals perhaps. I mean, it's beyond words, really. And this fourth one that Nebuchadnezzar sees, he identifies in the King James and the New King James as one like the Son of God. The King James and the New King James are the only translations that I know of that render this passage this way, at least of those that I consulted. If you're reading out of almost any of the other translations, how is it rendered? One like what? A son of the gods. A son of the gods. That's how the ASV, NAS, ESV, NIV render it. Now, this word for gods can mean God. It can mean God and is used that way in this book. However, it also does refer to the gods. Verse 12, verse 14 here in the same chapter, it's this word that's rendered gods. This is the only place in the Old Testament where the expression the Son of God appears. And we've got reason to believe that it may appear here without foundation. Furthermore, Jesus was not yet the Son of God. When does Jesus become the Son of God? When He comes in the flesh. And then He is the Son of God again in His resurrection, Acts 13. And there may be another level at which He is the Son of God. This is not a name He has yet gained by inheritance. This is not yet a name He has gained by coming in the flesh and doing His work. And I have no reason to believe, unless it's this passage, that Nebuchadnezzar would have any concept of the Son of God anyway. Aside from this, in the King James and New King James, the Son of God only appears, that expression, in the New Testament, which makes sense to me. So, I'm not going to say with absolute certainty this is not the pre-incarnate word. It could have been. But I'm not sure I have enough evidence here to believe that. And in light of what I see in verse 28 as well, notice what Nebuchadnezzar says later. Nebuchadnezzar spoke, saying, "Blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who sent His angel." And I know the New King James capitalizes that, but that was the decision of the translators. I think that this was just perhaps Nebuchadnezzar's way of saying, I see this personage in there, and he's not a human. He has heavenly characteristics. It's a spiritual being in there. And notice chapter 6, verse 22, also, after Daniel was saved in the lion's den, we see something similar. You know, Darius comes there in the morning, "Are you okay?" And Daniel says in Daniel 6, 22, "My God sent His angel and shut the lion's mouth so that they have not hurt me." So I think we may have kind of a parallel thing there. Yes, Steve?
Didn't the Assyrians as well as the Babylonians depict something like see described in Ezekiel, the cherubim, the winged lions, and that sort of thing? There was some concept of these heavenly beings in earlier days.
Yeah, that may be. I remember being in Cairo in 1995. Actually, Keith and I were standing side by side near one of the sarcophagi of King Tut. And here were all these, you know, inscriptions, these engravings in the gold of what looked something like, you know, angels. And I asked him, what's this about? You know, at that point in my life, the idea of a pagan people down there having pictures of angels, what's going on here? And just Keith made the remark at the time, remember the common denominator is God. And all these people have come from with God in the background. And so, yeah, there may have been some knowledge among the people that would have lined up with the truth at some points. Yes. Yes, Tom.
Do you remember how that's worded in the Septuagint?
No, I don't. Does anyone here have that information?
As I recall, it's something about he saw them walking in the midst of the fire, singing praises and glorifying God or blessing God, something to that effect. Very similar to Paul and Silas in prison in Philippi.
Interesting.
But the King, most of our modern translations just has that they were walking in the bridge, in the furnace.
Well, there is the book that goes with the Apocrypha that was composed supposedly to show what they sang while they were in the fire. As far as I know, the Jews never accepted that as canonical, the Song of the Three Holy Children. But that's interesting.
It's in the Septuagint, I believe, as I recall.
Okay.
That it's the that they were singing.
Okay. Let's go on. Find my place here. Verse 26. Then Nebuchadnezzar went near the mouth of the burning fiery furnace and spoke, saying, Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego, servants of the Most High God. Did you hear that? Servants of the Most High God. This is the first time we hear it. He'll use it three times in the next chapter. He's on his way. Servants of the Most High God, come out and come here. Then Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego came from the midst of the fire. Now, verse 27 I had read over. I don't know that I had ever picked up on this. And the satraps, administrators, governors, and the king's counselors gathered together, and they saw these men on whose bodies the fire had no power. The hair of their head was not singed, nor were their garments affected, and the smell of fire was not on them. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, I'll just cave in here in a little bit. They come out of the fire, and either as they're coming out of the fire, or after they've come out of the fire, who's there? All these officials. I don't remember that. That this wonderful work of God is not just seen by the king. It's seen by the king and all these officials. And where are these officials going to go when we're done with this dedication ceremony? They're going to go back home. And what are they likely to do? You'll never believe what I saw. And word begins to get out. And the name of Jehovah is glorified more and more in the eyes of the Gentiles. Most High God. Verse 27. And the satraps, administrators, governors, and the king's counselors gathered together. Oh, we read that. Pardon me. Verse 28. Nebuchadnezzar spoke, saying, and he says this in front of these people, as far as we can tell here. It seems like he may have. Blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who sent his angel and delivered his servants who trusted in him. And they have frustrated the king's word. Wow. This is an admission, potentially making in front of all these people. My word has been frustrated. And yielded their bodies, as should we all, that they should not serve nor worship any god except their own God. Therefore, I make a decree. Here's your second evangelistic exhortation. We can count the previous verse as well. I make a decree that any people, nation, or language which speaks anything amiss against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego shall be cut in pieces, and their houses shall be made an ash heap, because there is no other God who can deliver like this. Then the king promoted Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the province of Babylon. Miracles garner attention. They did that in the Gospels and in the book of Acts, and they did it here. And because the attention was garnered, there was opportunity here for the truth to be stated before many. They saw these men on whose bodies the fire had no power. Like witnesses, they could go out into the kingdom and declare what they had seen. And it's blessed be the God of these three men, not these three men. It's blessed be the God of these three men. Nebuchadnezzar is learning, and some others are along the way. Any comments on chapter 3? Yes, Larry. Well, the group that accused him is called the Chaldeans in verse 8. Maybe there was some overlap. That's possible. Okay. Yeah. They're vindicated. Thank you. Wait.
Just to confirm what Paul was saying about the Septuagint in Daniel 3:24, that Nebuchadnezzar heard the singing phrases. And verse 25, it says, the fourth is like the Son of God. And that's Britain's translation.
Thank you. Anything else? Seemed like I had an... Yes. Yeah, that's the big question. I don't know. Daniel held a very high position. I mean, if he is something like a Secretary of State or Prime Minister, it's very easy to believe he's off somewhere, visiting a province elsewhere, doing some work elsewhere. So, you know, I don't know is the true answer. But that's my speculation. I think we can be sure he's not bowing. So, yeah. Yes.
Is
wherever that was. Peta?
I just thought it was interesting in verse 29 where he says that it won't be better than any other god, but he's not yet to the point where he's
right. That's right. That's right. Imagine being raised with that idea your whole life. I mean, you've believed this your whole life. It's been a part of your life, day in and day out. You had a little idol here and a little idol there, and you made a point to do all these things. And I mean, as hard as change is for us in general, I mean, just let someone take your seat tomorrow. And that can become a big deal. I'm okay with change, but I know some of you aren't. No. Change can be very difficult. I just had someone tell me recently that change is very difficult for him. And he's been blessed not to have to make some. But you can see, I think we can at least we can grasp the concept that this would take a gradual change. It would be difficult to just leave it behind immediately. But he's on his way. Dwayne?
Yeah. Is there any reason to believe we're talking about the gold image that is a human image?
No, I can't prove that. No. No.
I mean, it could be like a totem pole or...
That's,
we do know the shape of it. I mean, we know the dimensions. We don't know if it's round or rectangular or square or
something. Well, we're limited by the dimensions it gives us, so that limits us to a point. But you raise a good question. Does anyone know of any reason why we would have to think that this probably is a humanoid shape? I've watched too much science fiction. Chapter 4. I guess a snake could reach a 10-to-1 ratio. We're talking about the image here in chapter 3, verse 1, whether or not that the initial image was a human-like form. Yes, Eldon.
Is it possible that in verse 15, he was giving them a second chance, and in verse 17, they refused it?
Thank you. Yes, absolutely. And I had that in my notes and walked right over it. Absolutely. You know, these men have probably been very good in their service and duty. And yeah, he's maybe giving them a second chance here. I heard this, but I'm going to give you the benefit of the doubt. We do this one more time.
Sometimes that comes to us too. Yeah. He may give us a second chance, but we need to stay with what the Lord
advises. Yeah, he'll give you a second chance to do the wrong thing. Yeah. Keith?
There is at least a hint that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, they understood the concept that the image was representative of Nebuchadnezzar himself. Because if you look at their statement in verse 18, we will not serve your gods or worship the image of gold you have set up. The emphasis is on him, not on the image. That he controlled the image. He ordered it produced. He set it up. He set up the order for them to worship. Mm-hmm. So what the image is, we can't tell. But they certainly understood that that image was representative of the authority and power of Nebuchadnezzar over the nation.
Mm-hmm.
Which is similar.
Let's go on to chapter 4. Chapter 4 gives every indication of being an edict issued by Nebuchadnezzar to his kingdom, which is kind of an interesting thing. For the archaeologists out there who are so intent in finding artifacts and things from an ancient culture, here's one right here. Here's a full-blown Babylonian edict come from the king to his nation. It's a record of his experience with insanity. It's a record of the lesson he learned in God's sovereignty. And as we're going to see, it begins and ends with praise. Perhaps we can regard chapter 4 as step 3 in Nebuchadnezzar learning who the true God is. Nebuchadnezzar the king, to all peoples, nations, and languages that dwell in all the earth, peace be multiplied to you. I thought it good to declare the signs and wonders that the Most High God has worked for me. How great are His signs and how mighty are His wonders. His kingdom is an everlasting kingdom and His dominion is from generation to generation. I, Nebuchadnezzar, was at rest in my house and flourishing in my palace. Now the word flourishing here means green, like a tree would be. I was doing well. I was healthy. I had everything I wanted, all the creature comforts and all that comes with it. Things were great. Flourishing in my palace. I saw a dream which made me afraid, and the thoughts on my bed and the visions of my head troubled me. Therefore I issued a decree to bring in all the wise men of Babylon before me that they might make known to me the interpretation of the dream. Now these guys have failed him before. Why is he calling on them now? Well, You know, admittedly, we don't know every little detail, of course, in Nebuchadnezzar's life. It may be that he'd had enough experiences with these guys where he thought they had done him some good, that he's still going to them. But it is interesting how different chapter 4 is from chapter 2. He brought them in that they might make known to him the interpretation. But then in verse 7, then the magicians, the astrologers, the Chaldeans, and the soothsayers came in, and I told them the dream. Now, he doesn't do to them what he did last time. And it's not like they proved themselves last time. But for some reason, this time, he goes ahead and he tells them his dream. And then what do? They do not make known to him the interpretation of the dream. It may be that they didn't even try to offer anything. Now, this is interesting, I think. What's happened here? Why last time they were... If he had offered them a dream, they probably would have piped something out. Well, this is what it meant. But there's evidence here possibly that they don't even try that this time. He doesn't ask them to tell him his dream, and then they maybe don't even try to offer an explanation. What has changed? Why is he dealing with these wise men differently, and why perhaps are they acting differently?
All right.
There's some apprehension here, perhaps. What else has changed? What happened at the end of chapter 2? Who's in charge of these guys? Daniel's in charge of these guys. Now, I don't know how long it's passed, but I imagine Daniel, perhaps, I mean, maybe the memo has gone out. We're going to exercise some integrity in this organization. Don't go saying stuff you don't know. And if you do know, if you don't know, I'm there. I can help you out. And here, by the way, is a better way to go about what we're supposed to be going about. Maybe there's some changes going on among the wise men. Nebuchadnezzar knows that, and he trusts Daniel, and that's playing into the association here. Just a theory. Verse 8, but at last Daniel came before me. His name is Belteshazzar, according to the name of my God. Bel, of course, as we talked earlier. In him is the spirit of the holy God. Now, this is the first time we're going to see this. We're going to see this phrase three times. And I told the dream before him, saying, Belteshazzar, chief of the musicians, because I know that the spirit of the holy God is in you, and no secret troubles you, explain to me the visions of my dream that I have seen and its interpretation. And then here's how the dream started. These were the visions of my head while on my bed. I was looking, and behold, a tree in the midst of the earth, and its height was great. The tree grew and became strong. Its height reached to the heavens, and it could be seen to the ends of all the earth. Its leaves were lovely, its fruit abundant, and in it was food for all. The beasts of the field found shade under it. The birds of the heavens dwelt in its branches, and all flesh was fed from it. I saw in the vision of my head while on my bed, and there was a watcher, a holy one, coming down from heaven. Now, in your King James, again, it's going to say a watcher and an holy one. However, most of the translations that I'm looking at have it in the singular, a watcher, a holy one. As I understand, the and is not in the original. So I think these terms may both refer to the same entity. And I think we may just be seeing a term here that the Bible's giving to an angel. An angel certainly meets these two words. An angel is holy. Jesus said so. Luke 9:26, Jesus referred to the holy angels. And angels are watchers. And how do we know that? Yeah, so 1 Peter 1:12 talks about how there are these things the prophets were saying, things which the angels desired to look into. There seems to have been an awareness on their part. 1 Timothy 3:16, when the mystery of godliness is being expressed, he was manifest in the flesh, justified in the spirit, seen by angels. The angels were there watching Jesus in his ministry. 1 Corinthians 11:10 talks about how the woman ought to have a symbol of authority on her head because of the angels. Perhaps suggestive of how they're watching, and they need to see a Christian woman behaving as she ought so that they get the right message. Because, one more passage, Ephesians 3:10, Paul says, to the intent that now the manifold wisdom of God might be made known by the church to the principalities and powers in the heavenly places. They were watching, at least in the first century, and I imagine they're still watching now, learning, waiting to see what God has in store. So I think we may just have angelic being referred to here. I saw the visions of my head while on my bed, and there was a watcher, a holy one, coming down from heaven. He cried aloud and said thus. Now, if I was at home with my kids, I'd start to lift up my voice, but I won't do that to you. Did that earlier, and it's probably a little much. Chop down the tree and cut off its branches. Strip off its leaves and scatter its fruit. Let the beasts get out from under it and the birds from its branches. This great tree, we're going to cut it down, we're going to strip it bare and tell all the animals that are hiding in it and finding refuge, get out. Nevertheless, leave the stump and roots in the earth, bound with a band of iron and bronze. Now, this may be referring to a band maybe comprised of two hoops that would go around that stump and bind it tight. This would keep it from cracking in the hot sun and then allow giving it places for the water to get in there and cause it to rot. What's the idea here? When you leave the roots and the stump there, why do you do that? Because you know what? We do it because we don't want to pay somebody to come dig it out. But what's the idea here? We leave it there because we're going to want this thing to grow back. We're cutting it down, but we intend to see it spring forth again. Bound with a band of iron and bronze in the tender grass of the field, let it be wet with the dew of heaven. And now we're not just talking about a tree. Let him graze with the beasts on the grass of the earth. Let his heart be changed from that of a man. Let him be given the heart of a beast. And let seven times pass over him. All right, this seven times, we're going to wait to talk about what happens to Nebuchadnezzar until we get later in the chapter. But this seven times, I can't prove it beyond a shadow of a doubt, but I think this may be referring to just 7 years. When we get to the seventh chapter, we're going to see a time, times, and half a time. That's clearly referring to a year. Although we see the same word time earlier in the seventh chapter, and it may be more general. But Josephus said these were years. Now, that's not gospel again, but here's what Josephus wrote. A little after this, the king saw in his sleep another vision, how he should fall from his dominion and feed among the wild beasts, and that when he had lived in this manner in the desert for 7 years, he should recover his dominion again. So I think that's interesting. So seven years possibly, this would go on. Verse 17, this decision is by the decree of the watchers. It is said to be the decree of the Most High in verse 24. Yes. He is dreaming. He dreamed that he saw the tree and that the tree was cut down and that the watcher is saying these things will happen. Yes.
He dreamed his own judgment or something?
Yes. That's exactly what he did.
Okay.
Well put. The decision is by the decree of the watchers and the sentence by the word of the holy ones in order that the living may know that the Most High rules in the kingdom of men, gives it to whomever he will, and sets over it the lowest of men. So this is what I saw, this is what I heard, Daniel, what's it mean? This dream I, King Nebuchadnezzar, have seen. Now you, Belteshazzar, declare its interpretation, since all the wise men of the kingdom are not able to make known to me the interpretation, but you are able, for the Spirit of the Holy God is in you. Then Daniel, whose name was Belteshazzar, was astonished for a time. Stricken dumb, appalled, dismayed, greatly perplexed are all different translations of this phrase. He's bothered. Troubled, it says. Why is he so bothered? He doesn't want to tell Nebuchadnezzar. And this is very interesting, isn't it? I don't get the impression that he's not wanting to tell Nebuchadnezzar because he's afraid of what Nebuchadnezzar will do to him. There's been some time passed here. Nebuchadnezzar and Daniel may now have a relationship. They've been working in conjunction with each other. No doubt Daniel has shown himself to be faithful. He's certainly shown himself to have the wisdom of God in him. Here's a relationship that's had time to develop, perhaps. And Daniel doesn't want to see this happen to the king. He doesn't really want to tell him. It's terrible news. It's the kind of news his enemies would love. And Nebuchadnezzar senses this. He says, the king spoke and said, Belteshazzar, do not let the dream or its interpretation trouble you. Just go ahead and tell me. Belteshazzar answered and said, my lord, may the dream concern those who hate you and its interpretation your enemies. The tree that you saw, which grew and became strong, whose height reached to the heavens and which could be seen by all the earth, whose leaves were lovely and its fruit abundant and which was food for all, under which the beasts of the field dwelt and whose branches the birds of the heaven had their home, it's you, O king, who have grown and become strong. For your greatness has grown and reaches to the heavens, and your dominion to the end of the earth. Now, people are likened to trees in the Bible. The man who meditates on the Word of God day and night, he shall be like a tree planted by the rivers of water. People and trees have a lot in common. They both grow. They both live relatively long. They both can bear fruit. They both can wither away. Apt symbol for a man. You're this tree, Nebuchadnezzar. And interestingly, Nebuchadnezzar has already dreamed about himself twice. Verse 23. And inasmuch as the king saw a watcher, a holy one coming down from heaven and saying, chop down the tree and destroy it, but leave its stump and roots in the earth, bound with a band of iron and bronze in the tender grass of the field. Let it be wet with the dew of heaven, and let him graze with the beasts of the field till seven times pass over him. This is the interpretation, O king, and this is the decree of the Most High which has come upon my lord the king. Verse 25, they shall drive you from men. Your dwelling shall be with the beasts of the field, and they shall make you eat grass like oxen. They shall wet you with the dew of heaven, and seven times shall pass over you, till you know that the Most High rules in the kingdom of men and gives it to whomever He chooses. Now, if someone had told you that, what would you say? I don't know what Nebuchadnezzar thought when he heard this from Daniel. Daniel had certainly proven himself to be reliable. It may have been you believe the unbelievable at this point. Perhaps in Daniel's mind, he'd seen enough teetering on the part of Nebuchadnezzar that this seemed believable just from a physical standpoint. But whatever the case, verse 26, Daniel goes on to say, and inasmuch as they gave the command to leave the stump and roots of the tree, your kingdom shall be assured to you after you come to know that heaven rules. Therefore, O king, now notice this. This is good. The interpretation is done, but Daniel's not done. Daniel cares about this man. Now, I don't want to make this all touchy-feely, but he does care about this man. Enough so that he speaks the truth in love. He speaks what may have been very uncomfortable to speak. In verse 27, he says, therefore, O king, let my advice be acceptable to you in light of what you've just learned. Break off your sins by being righteous. Now, this is the man at the top of the kingdom that's at the top of the world, and Daniel just told him, you're a sinner. Stop it. Your iniquities, break them off by showing mercy to the poor. All this riches you've got, this golden city you have, stop just lavishing it on your temples and on yourself. Give it to those in need. Perhaps there may be a lengthening of your prosperity. In the days of Jonah, when he went to Nineveh, remember, he said, you know, within 40 days the city is going to be overthrown, and the king of Nineveh called the nation, called the city to repentance. And in Jonah chapter 3, verse 9, here's the city in sackcloth and ashes and fasting and so forth, and the king says, let's do all this. Who can tell if God will turn and relent and turn away from His fierce anger so that we may not perish? We need to do the right thing here. I don't know if God's going to turn from His anger, but the only chance we have of Him turning from His anger is if we repent, so let's do it. And we'll see what God does. There's a similar attitude expressed in the book of Joel. We may see the same thing in chapter 8 of the book of Acts from Peter in his conversation with Simon. Perhaps. All we can do is do the right thing. God's the ultimate arbiter. But the only chance we have is doing the right thing. So, King, I don't know if a change of lifestyle on your part is going to be enough in God's eyes that He will change the way He's planning this. But it's the only chance you've got. So please do it. Hear me, please, and do this. Well, I don't know what Nebuchadnezzar did. But a year went by. Verse 28, all this came upon King Nebuchadnezzar. At the end of the 12 months, he was walking about the royal palace of Babylon. The king spoke, saying, I don't know if he's talking to himself or he's talking to some people with him or just what's going on here. Is not this great Babylon that I have built for a royal dwelling for by my mighty power and for the honor of my majesty? If we had more time, we could spend some time talking about the grandeur of Babylon. But it was a grand place. And in Nebuchadnezzar's eyes, what was that grand place for? Him. My majesty. My power. My mighty power. I, me. While the word was still in the king's mouth, a voice fell from heaven. King Nebuchadnezzar, to you it is spoken. The kingdom has departed from you. And they shall drive you from men, and your dwelling shall be with the beasts of the field. They shall make you eat grass like oxen, and seven times shall pass over you until you know that the Most High rules in the kingdom of men and gives it to whomever He chooses. Just exactly as it had been promised and predicted, so it comes to pass. That very hour in verse 33, the word was fulfilled concerning Nebuchadnezzar. He was driven from men and ate grass like oxen. His body was wet with the dew of heaven till his hair had grown like eagle's feathers and his nails like bird's claws. And our skeptic friend says, this is exactly one of the reasons I don't believe in your book. concerning this thing that's going on with Nebuchadnezzar. Clearly he's behaving in an insane way. Whether God's working apart from nature or in conjunction with nature here, I don't know. But the man, by all appearances, is insane. He thinks he's an animal. He's behaving like an animal. And you think, well, how could these people drive him away? How could they just lead him out with the animals? Well, what else are you going to do with him? I mean, you could confine him in a cell, I suppose. I mean, as far as I know, they don't have any drug they can, plug him with to desensitize him and do the sort of things we do to people today. Not that our way is any better. I learned last night, I didn't know this, Patrick Henry, some of you already know where I'm going with this probably, the famous speaker of the Revolution, whom Thomas Jefferson wasn't particularly fond of, that famous speech he gave, "Is life so dear or peace so sweet as to be purchased at the price of chains and slavery?" When he said that, his wife was in bondage, in chains or in some kind of 17th to 18th century straitjacket in his cellar, because his wife was insane. And Sarah Shelton Henry was her name. I think it may have been a bit of a secret at the time. He fed her. He took care of her to a point. And what he was doing for her may have been better than the other options he had at the time. But what do you do when someone's insane? So maybe it's just out of their own safety, not knowing what else to do. He's driven out from among men. Maybe he had guys under him who were more than happy to see him go. He begins eating grass like an ox, which is interesting. An ox in Scripture is an animal of servitude. It's an animal that has been made in subjection to others. He's the one that carries the yoke. He's eating an ox. The great lion, an eagle, is now eating like an ox. His hair grows like eagle's feathers. This may be speaking to the length of his hair, but it may also be referring to the unkempt and matted appearance. There is an eagle called the ossifrage eagle, and if you want me to spell that for you later, I can. But if you look up pictures on the internet, you can see it. It's got feathers along its chest, of course, but they all kind of have this matted, unkempt appearance, and that could be the idea. I mean, here's a man living out in the wild, and hair probably is growing along, and probably just kind of unsightly and certainly not well cared for. Nails become like bird's claws, maybe longer, thicker, and stronger with the way he's using them. And they curl. I guess she doesn't send any emails. Nebuchadnezzar may have been suffering from a condition known as this. I've seen it go by different things. Zoanthropy, insania, zoanthropica. I think that might be a general term. What he may have had specifically is this right here. A cow is a bovine. Anthropos, the Greek word for a man. This is a man who thinks he's an animal. This is a man who thinks he's a cow. And there have actually been instances of this sort of thing, documented and observed. And I'd like to read to you one. It's reputed to be one anyway, by a Dr. Raymond Harrison. He claims that in 1946, in a British mental institution, he got to observe this very thing. I saw this quote in several places on the net. I need to do some more research, so please don't take this as absolute fact, but it is interesting if it's true. He writes, "A great many doctors spend an entire busy professional career without once encountering an instance of this kind of monomania described in the book of Daniel. The present writer therefore considers himself particularly fortunate to have actually observed a clinical case of zoanthropy in a British mental institution in 1946. The patient was in his early 20s, who reportedly had been hospitalized for about 5 years. His symptoms were well developed on admission, and diagnosis was immediate and conclusive. He was of average height and weight with good physique and was in excellent bodily health. His mental symptoms included pronounced antisocial tendencies, and because of this, he spent the entire day from dawn to dusk outdoors in the grounds of the institution. His daily routine consisted of wandering around the magnificent lawns with which the otherwise dingy hospital situation was graced, and it was his custom to pluck up and eat handfuls of the grass as he went along. On observation, he was seen to discriminate carefully between grass and weeds, and on inquiry from the attendant, the writer was told the diet of this patient consisted exclusively of grass from the hospital lawns. He never ate institutional food with the other inmates, and his only water, his only drink was water. So if any of you know more about that, I'd sure like to know about it. That doctor is a Dr. Raymond Harrison. Let me, our time is up. We'll be able to close this up quickly, hopefully tomorrow afternoon, and plow through chapter 5 and chapter 6.